So good evening, everyone. So this is my first time in your new home here. I've come to Seattle twice before to give Dharma talks, and I was in the other place, so I'm happy to be here. It's a beautiful setting here. And it was actually reminding me of, I looked back to see what I talked about in other times that I've come here, and the first one was about catching the right thought trains. So I thought, oh, I should have saved that one for this location, since you've got like the good metaphors going on with the trains there. And, so I like urban Dharma. I feel like we can use whatever it is that is around us to help us wake up. So hopefully the trains can be that for you too, of either sounds that can suddenly bring you out of your reverie, or even the metaphor of different trains of thought that go through, or you know, something like that. So, but today I'd like to talk to you about 13 ways of looking at Dharma practice. And some of you might have some vague familiarity with a title like this. So this came about because I have been reflecting on different relationships that we have to our practice. And hopefully this is interesting for those of you who are both new to practice and considering, you know, what does this mean, this meditation? What is this Dharma? How to relate to this? And then also, particularly for those of you who have actually been at it for a while, have been in this for a while. So like any kind of relationship that you have to something, it helps to renew, re-examine, reinvigorate from time to time. So this is because of one of the aspects of what we learn in Dharma practice, that everything is always changing. So, for example, any relationship that you've had in your life that have gone on for some time, you know, say, let's say like you get a dog. Anyone here has a dog? You got it as a puppy. So you got the dog as a puppy maybe, and then it was one kind of relationship you had, you and your puppy. And then 10 years later, like you're 10 years older and the puppy is actually 70 dog years older, you know, is a different entity, right? So then you have to relate to the dog differently. Or in a long relationship with a kid, with a child also. You know, we have to learn to relate to the child differently as the child is growing. And in fact, it annoys kids a lot if you try to relate to them when they're teenagers as if they're small children. You know, we have to sort of start to understand and relate differently. Even to one's life of exercise. You know, as we get older and our body changes, we might not do the same things that we did to stay healthy physically. But it helps to have some kind of physical practice going. So we have to kind of stay alive in our relationship to this element of our physical life too. So I would say it's helpful to consider your Dharma practice and what is my relationship to this. And the reference of, you know, why 13 is a slight homage to this poem called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird by Wallace Stevens. A little bit of which I was reminded of as I flew into Seattle. You could see, it was a very nice clear day, so you could see some of the beautiful mountains coming in. So among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. The river is moving, the blackbird must be flying. So there's only 3 of the 13 of the blackbird, but now let's start with the Dharma practice. So you could cast your mind back to when you began your Dharma practice, and that could have been an hour ago, or some years ago, or decades ago. And maybe, you know, what was your impetus for showing up here tonight, or for beginning this exploration, beginning this path? And for many people, even if your practice life has been only an hour, you might have changed in what your original motivation was and then what it is now, and what you're looking for, what you're seeking. And it's good to appreciate that being who we were, that person who we were, whether it was an hour ago or a decade ago or 30 years ago. Kind of honor what it was that was our motivation, what we were seeking. But also to acknowledge what actually seems to be true right now for us. You know, what is the question that's actually alive for us now? And what is our motivation at the moment? So one of the main motivations, and this is top motivations over 2,600 years for getting into Dharma practice, is suffering, dukkha. Right? And this could be from your kind of low-grade stress variety of suffering to the most difficult things that we face in our human life, in the life of dealing with sickness, dealing with death, dealing with sudden loss in our own abilities or with family members, loved ones, children, jobs, breakups, you know, all of that. So many times people come to Dharma practice with some big kind of kick in the pants from life, you could say, searching for some relief. And then many times that seems to, you know, kind of alleviate a little bit. And then you're left trying to understand what it is that you're doing when you sit. Like, why am I doing this now? Or I'm feeling a bit lost in our relationship to the practice. So we can start with some of these motivations that might come up. And you know, one of the common ones that now is reason people begin with what is often called mindfulness practices for stress reduction. So they're feeling stress and they feel like, okay, I want some relief from that. And I hear this word being tossed around, mindfulness. I can learn to follow my breathing and find some rest through meditation. So that's good. Stress reduction is good. And rest is also good. So one way of looking at practice also is just you have this very busy life with many to-do lists and checklists and things to do. And so in some ways, sometimes we can feel like our whole life and energy and the body is like, you know, like this engine that's constantly going. And sometimes it's just when we sit at some moment of even idling the vehicle. Kind of like, you know, if you have a gas car, not a hybrid car, but a gas car at a stoplight, you know, it stopped, but it still is like. So just a moment of rest there before accelerating again, pushing on. So rest is good. Rest for the body, rest for the mind. Having some brief period in which we aren't having to be doing things, but actually experiencing being in some way. It can be very restful. Meditation can be restful for the mind, restful for the body. And this is a good thing. So stress reduction, rest. Now one of the translations for the word sati, which is often translated as mindfulness, is of remembering. So our practice can actually be one of remembering. And remembering can have several different meanings. So if you think of members as the different parts of your body, or even the parts of your mind, in some ways we're pulling those together again, you know, remembering, reconnecting, reintegrating in some way as we practice. And this too is a very good thing, and it's a worthwhile use of our time to allow ourselves to reintegrate in some way. So some part of that is the development of collectedness, of concentration, you know, bringing back in, developing the ability to focus, the energy that's often dissipated a lot during our life. So I told you that two times ago when I came here, I was talking about the catching the right thought trains, and then I looked at what I talked about the last time I came, and it was about mental training, the radical path of mental training. So I was last year on this big kick about like mental fitness, and it's definitely a framing that can be helpful about meditation, and then just about the path of Dharma as of one of mental training. So just as it's helpful for us to engage in physical training, it's helpful for all of us to engage in the training of the mind. And some people might have great aspirations with their physical training to be Olympic athletes or compete. But we've kind of accepted now that for all of us, it's good to have some level of physical fitness. So likewise, it's actually good for all of us to develop some level of mental fitness. So developing the ability to pay attention, developing the ability to cultivate balance, to cultivate collectiveness, to cultivate all of the good qualities that come from our meditation practice. And sometimes the way to look at this training also is that it's a training for attending to whatever else shows up in the rest of our life. So when we sit, it's kind of under the simplest of conditions to know what's happening and to be able to respond with awareness, to cultivate wisdom, to cultivate compassion. And then that enables us to move into the more complex world of interactions with people and work and fighting over parking spaces and, you know, all the stuff that happens in the outside world. And my favorite quote about this has been the one from Bruce Lee, who I know is also connected to Seattle, which is that under duress, we do not rise to the level of our expectations, but we fall to the level of our training. Under duress, we do not rise to the level of our expectations, but we fall to the level of our training. So this is true both physically, but also certainly in terms of the qualities of the mind. So it may seem like nothing's happening when you're practicing, but we're actually cultivating, training ourselves in ways that will serve us when we get tested by life, when things are more challenging. So now some of these different ways of looking at Dharma practice that I'm going to present to you will be actually opposite and seemingly contradictory. So I suggest you just take whichever ones are helpful for you. And really all of this is just kind of skillful means, like whatever it is that helps you at this particular point to engage is good. So from this, the mental training aspect, then it's good to do it regularly, it's good to do it every day, it's good to do it as much as possible, vigorously and so on. But the training happens not just during the meditation, it's good to notice the training that happens outside also. So we're actually always training ourselves in some way or another, depending on what's arising and what we're cultivating in the mind and heart through what we say, through what we do, through actions of generosity, through actions of harming. And another way to look particularly at meditation practice is really just as one part of a whole mandala of Dharma practice. So it's helpful to remember that this is an eightfold path. And I get some people coming to me sometimes very distressed about the fact that they aren't sitting regularly. Like they want to sit regularly. They know they should sit regularly. They used to sit regularly. Other people they know sit regularly. All meditation teachers tell them they should sit regularly. But then quietly, secretly, they say, but I'm not doing it. So how to relate to that? So some of the ones that I said before would say, like, just do it, right? Another way to look at it is, are you engaged somewhere along the Eightfold Path? You know, is there some aspect of the bigger picture of cultivation of Dharma that is alive for you? And that could be around some of the training precepts, so attending to speech, for example, or paying attention to your actions. It could be around engaging with questions of livelihood. It could be around honing wise view. Now, the meditation itself will support all of these, certainly, but it's something to consider sometimes, like, am I engaged somewhere? And okay, so then let me put energy towards that, you know, focus on that as my main training right now. So now we're coming to about number 6, I'd say. So laboratory time, lab time. So this one is focused on the aspect of the practice, particularly meditation practice, that's around cultivating investigation. So understanding how this mind and body system works. You know, what is going on in this? Like, what is the impact of the sound on the mind and the body? How does it work that there's an arising of self? Is there really anyone there? You know, all of these questions we can check out through this lab of meditation practice. And all of the meditation techniques in some ways are tools and technologies, you could say, that allow us to directly understand and answer these questions. So particularly for those who are have a curious mind, are interested, you could consider this important lab time to answer questions that are whatever the deepest questions you have are about your life. You know, give yourself that time to look into them. Using this different way of knowing that we have, this different way of knowing that we practice and that we learn through developing awareness. Now, I said that some of these different ways will contradict each other, and some of you will already know this, that once you start looking into the mind and body system, once you start looking into the questions of who I am, sometimes you go beyond stress reduction to stress induction. Because then you might start to realize, like, oh, there isn't actually a me there in the same way that I originally was expecting. So that can cause some stress, but we'll call this good stress. Sometimes people come who are have been on retreats, and they come back from retreat and they try and have a regular meditation practice, and it feels so mundane. It feels actually very prosaic, boring. It feels even like taking out the garbage. So this is also one perspective on your practice, taking out the garbage. So why should I sit and take out the garbage? Because if you don't take out the garbage piles up, just as it does in your house. So even if it feels at the end of the day like all I'm doing is rehashing conversations about what happened at work or what happened with my family and feeling that, what that feeling is, allowing it to let go. You know, it feels like nothing superbly profound is happening. Still do it. So still practice that way. We're practicing non-identification. And we actually are allowing things to unwind in a way that is, in a positive way, taking out the garbage, I would say. So if the mental fitness metaphor didn't work for you so much, if you actually dislike going to the gym overall, and that was like not inspiring, here's a different one, which is about gardening. So this is cultivating the mind. And this metaphor of cultivating the mind is used a lot in the teachings of the Buddha. And this is actually like to kind of till the soil, create the fertile conditions for the arising of wisdom, for the arising of liberation. So I have a group in San Francisco that I teach on Monday nights, and we've been going through the 7 factors of awakening in this group. And the way we've been looking at them is each individually learning about them, trying to cultivate them, and considering them kind of like the elements that create a fertile soil in the mind for awakening. So I used to live in Massachusetts some time ago, before moving to California. And at one point I lived in a group house with a number of other people, young people. And I decided we were going to have a garden. But no one had had a garden in that house for some time, so we didn't really know, like, is the soil good? Will things grow here? Is it healthy soil? So we sent away a little soil sample to the University of Massachusetts Agriculture School. And then they sent back this analysis of our soil, like what was in it, what percentage of this and that. And they actually sent us a recipe for what we should add to the soil to have a really good garden. And it was a bunch of things that I hadn't even heard about. It would never have occurred to me to add them to the soil. But we went out beautifully and got all this stuff. So, like mulch and manure, and it was even like dried blood, I think, and you know, all kinds of stuff, mealy stuff. And so we mixed it all up, we made a box, you know. And then we planted some seeds there and watered them and waited and waited. And then some of these little shoots started coming up. And then over the spring, we had the most incredible garden that I've ever seen. Yeah. We had sunflowers, we had tomatoes, we had zucchini, we had a whole patch of basil. And we didn't think everything would grow, and there were many people in the house, so everyone planted stuff that they were interested in. So it was this huge hodgepodge of different vegetables, all of them like going crazy, you know, like producing huge zucchinis and basil, all this stuff. So it's like actually because we created this very positive, fertile soil system, it was the perfect conditions for all of this stuff to grow. So you could consider in some ways then your practice is actually supporting the cultivation of the garden of your mind. You're developing these positive qualities of mind. And we had these, you got this like similar to what I got from the agriculture department. You know, we got a list from the Buddha of like, the different things that you know, there in your mind to create a fertile garden, you know, fertile air for development of wisdom. So if the gardening metaphor works for you, you could consider that too. And that we're also planting seeds, we're planting seeds all the time for wholesome arisings, for cultivation of positive mind states, and then actually weeding also. So pulling up the unwholesome ones as they arise too. So I believe we're in number 10 now. So Dharma practice is buying a lottery ticket. So this is related to the old saying that goes, you know, that awakening or enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. So yeah, it can happen anytime. You know, that which we need to see to awaken is there in every single moment. But doing Dharma practice creates the conditions for that to be seen. So you could consider this the buying a lottery ticket for the awakening sweepstakes. So what I mean when I say this, it's there in every moment, is that which we talk about even as Dharma, we consider Dharma is the truth of the way things are. So it's actually, on nature is one of my favorite translations of this. And so this comes to another way we can consider it, that our practice itself is actually aligning ourselves with the truth of how things are. So when we live in alignment with this, we have less stress, we have less suffering, we're living free from delusion, we actually live in harmony with others. We don't cause as much suffering for ourselves and others. My favorite example for this is that, you know, we could see different laws of nature and then learn to align ourselves with them, just as in the Dharma overall. So one of the simple ones we can observe is the law of gravity. So the law of gravity is something that you're not born knowing. And you see sometimes babies learning about this by dropping things and then seeing what happens. So, you know, like, oh, this drops, and like, okay, it falls to the ground. You can see that, right? So then, well, what if you do it on this side? Like, yep, also falls, you know. What if you're not looking? But it also falls. So then you get the picture after a while. The babies understand this, like, oh, when I will drop things off the high chair, then that will fall to the ground. And there's actually no need to even understand the mathematical equation for that, or who is running that, or, you know, any of that. It's just understanding this and then living in alignment with that. So living in alignment with that means that, you know, if I want to place this glass of water, it's better not to place it in midair. I understand that. But if I place it on the table, then there's less broken glass, spilled water, ruined microphones, right, all of that. So I learned to live in alignment with that, and I lead a happier, more harmonious life. And then if by chance, sometime, accidentally, something happens like that, this falls over, I actually understand what happened. So, you know, I can reach out and pick it up and put it back, and that's all. So it's minus some additional drama of, like, why did this happen to me? Why now? You know? Like all of this stuff that otherwise comes to us in our life when things that are naturally occurring are happening, but we're taking it personally. You know? So in this way, we could consider our practice as this alignment with the laws of nature. You know, seeing clearly and understanding what's actually true about our bodies, about our minds, about impermanence, about emptiness, about what's true about who we really are, you know, what we can consider to be ourselves. So this realignment, sometimes you could even consider like for cars or bicycles. You have to true up the wheels periodically in bicycles. There might be some cyclists here, right? So after you ride your bike for a while, the bike gets like a little bit wobbly sometimes. So then you actually take the bike wheel, put it on a little metal stand. I used to work in a bike shop at one time, so I know this, right? And then you have to spin it back and forth and you tweak the spokes, like this one this way, this one this way. And so then it switches the tension in different areas of the bicycle wheel until it spins smoothly. And interestingly, you know, this word dukkha of strain, suffering, stress is actually related to like something that is not moving smoothly. So in those times it was like a potter's wheel that was like spinning but not spinning so smoothly, or like a wheel with an axle, and the axle, it doesn't totally fit well. You know, so there's a little. Or the modern equivalent to this is like if you're sitting at a table, the cafe, and there's a little like, you know, like one of the legs is up a little bit. You know, it's a little off. So it's like that, this, you know, so then realigning. And the realigning in that case, usually you stick a little napkins or a piece of wood under something like that's stable. So it's like this. It's like, oh, we actually stabilize the mind through this realignment. And then we can meet whatever comes with grace, with wisdom. So what do we learn through this realignment? So at some stages in the practice, what can become apparent and what can be the framing of the whole practice is actually some sense of resting and not knowing. So as we pay attention to why the mind is kicking up so much thought or going to the past, going to the future, there's a lot of machinating that has to do with trying to control external factors that are not under our control. Observe your mind, like what does it get up to? You know, what kind of thoughts are there and like what's behind all of that? So there's some way in which practice can be practicing resting and not knowing. You know, practicing resting and not knowing what's going to be here the next second. Practicing resting and not knowing what it is that appears in this next moment as who I think I am. Practicing resting and not knowing who the person across from me is. Can I allow them to arise and present just as they are and not as my projection of who they used to be, who I want them to be, who I imagine them to be? So this is a beautiful practice. If you just sit every day practicing resting and not knowing the best you can. It's counter to any kind of sense of gaining or acquisition, or in this way it is counter even to the, you know, mental fitness, getting different things metaphor. But it's a very helpful development of wisdom. And maybe a more cryptic kind of thing. But even noticing when there's a solidity of knowing rushing in or wanting to know rushing in, and then seeing, like, okay, can I relax into this openness? Into seeing what's actually true about life, which is that it emerges in some unique and creative way in each moment, which usually is actually more interesting, amazing, even when terrible, than what my script for it is, than what I expected to have happen. So now we're getting into some of the kind of bigger picture ways of looking at Dharma practice. And in some ways this next one goes back to the beginning, which is about taking refuge. A Dharma practice as taking refuge. So for many people who come to practice with a lot of suffering, we're seeking some refuge from this great difficulty that has come to us in our life that we don't know how to hold. And in some ways, this is one of the most profound framings, I think, of the Dharma itself, of the path itself, is about, you know, what is true refuge? What can we actually go to for safety as human beings in this life? Where can we find some reliable place to rest? It's a very poignant question to hold. And as we look, we see that everything that's in experiential reality is actually changing. And so it's difficult to find a place to rest. In any experience, in any person, in any title, all the things that we thought were places to find refuge are actually flawed and subject also to change. So here we go beyond some of the previous framings as activities or alignment and some connection to resting in something larger, is taking refuge. You know, connecting with this deeper knowing that our lives are part of something larger. And connect with that is that we're actually not even doing this practice just for ourselves. So the cultivation of these qualities of wisdom, of love, of compassion, is actually for all of us. So this undermines the idea that, you know, I am a meditator trying to meditate. I am a practitioner trying to practice. There's some deep surrender that happens, that can happen when practice is held like this. It's a taking of refuge. Often when I teach retreats, I encourage people in some way to consider like this. And you know, I told you this is the first time I came to your building, and I was very happy to see the giant sign on the top saying, "Treasures from the Sea." Isn't that what it says? It says something like that, right? Treasures from the sea, yeah. So partly why this made me happy is because, you know, one of my favorite metaphors in retreat, you know, people wonder, like, how do I begin retreat? And they come somewhere and, you know, you're figuring out logistics and stuff. And then I like to tell people just to, like, fall backwards as if you're going deep sea diving. You know, like you're in a boat and you have your flippers and you have an oxygen tank and mask, and just fall backwards and just trust and see what's there. Now, when you go and retreat, one of the most unusual aspects, kind of socially, logistically, that people talk about, worry about, ask about the silence. You know, you go on a silent retreat. And usually you go in the retreat, you come back, and people who haven't been on retreat first and foremost want to know, like, what was it like to not talk? Okay. Like, what was silence like? Was it hard? Was it easy? Did people break the silence? Yeah. And I always tell people, you know, this is funny to me, because it's kind of like silence is just the wetsuit that allows you to go down deep, you know, and to see all the amazing things that you can learn about the Dharma, about nature, about life, about the mind and body, about reality. So it's kind of like if you went on some amazing diving expedition somewhere and you came back and all everyone asked about was the wetsuit, you know, like, what was it like? Was it hard to put on? Was it hard to take off? Did it stick to you? You know? You're like, you don't want to know about the fish? Or the coral? No, nothing, you know. But people don't, you know, we don't know, right? So treasures of the sea. So in some way, every time you sit, you can imagine, you know, you just allow yourself to fall backwards and see what you can see, right? The treasures of the sea are there. So maybe when you come here, you can imagine that, like, oh, okay, I'm entering the treasures of the sea. Okay, and now the last one I'll say, number 13, is something connected also to as your Dharma practice as a sacred ritual. So there's something that brought you here to this path. You know, there's something that has led you so far. And for most people here, it's not because someone told you you should do it, or there's some external forces. You know, there's some deep intrinsic motivation that has brought you here on a Friday night in a city like Seattle. And there's so many other things you could be up to. And there's some deep motivation that has kept you coming back, for those of you who have come repeatedly. So when I asked you in the beginning to consider, you know, what was it like that made you come first and find this practice? In some ways you could consider that like some spark. You know, there's some spark or like this homing device for truth that we all have in some way, you know. And so then you followed that, you know, you followed that through different permutations and ups and downs, and going to read this book and see this teacher and different things, you know. And then we get busy in our life, you know, with all of the logistical things that are necessary for maintaining a life, for doing carpool and groceries and fixing stuff in the house and getting haircuts and, you know. And all that stuff is good and important to do, and to do with as much care and kindness as we can. But not to allow yourself to forget about that spark, you know, that precious spark. So in some way then, there's a sacred ritual that could be considered about your practice. And it's kind of like tending this fire. So even like when you sit, if you're paying attention to your breath, it's like blowing on the spark each breath, you know. You're allowing that to catch fire. You're allowing that to ignite. So allowing the Dharma to infuse your heart, to infuse your mind. You know, whatever that means for you. Whatever it is that spark was, you know, treasure that, honor that, and give yourself the time and space to attend to that. And then see where that goes. You know, be open to that. So this is recognizing, you know, it could be seen as a training and in some kind of nuts and bolt ways, and if that's motivating for you, that's great. But there also is something very special that can be happening here. You know, there's something actually very unusual and sacred about the practice, about the Dharma. And so it's helpful to honor that. So I'll tell you one more story that is somewhat related to this, but in a somewhat more lighthearted way. So last year I went to teach in New York, and then I had to go to Boston, and I was teaching at IMS, as Bonnie said. And for some reason, when I was trying to get from where I was in Brooklyn to the bus, one of the subway lines was actually stopped, which is an extremely unusual thing in New York. So I didn't know why and figured out a way around. And so later I found out the reason that the subway line had stopped was because there were these kittens that got loose on the subway tracks. And so they actually had shut down the subway line so they could save the kittens. So there was like three kittens, someone had seen them and alerted the, I guess, MTA officials. And it's not something you expect in New York, you know, that they're gonna shut down the subway to save kittens, but they actually did this, you know. And the story about it was very sweet, because you had these MTA, you know, burly guys going around with flashlights, like, you know. And then, you know, they reported very, with much joy. They were like, oh yeah, you know, we didn't want them to touch the third rail. We were worried we were gonna get hit by the trains, and, you know, but we're really happy that we got all of them. And they showed pictures of them holding the kittens and things. So it reminds me of this, you know, it's like, oh, there's something beautiful inside, you know, in your heart. There's something beautiful that sometimes gets lost. So in your practice, you can allow yourself the moments to stop and to find that again. So imagine, like, you know, there's kittens lost inside of you. You must find them. Save the kittens. So every day you devote a little bit of time to this, you know. And this could be, you know, the beautiful qualities of your own heart, you know. Your own natural compassion, your own natural joy, your integrity. You know, all of these different beautiful qualities that we have that you can take a beating in the world in some ways. You know, it's difficult to maintain. So if that story is at all inspiring to you, you can have a moment of every day when you stop and look for the kittens and find them. Right? And then pet them when you find them, be very happy. So, 13 ways of looking at Dharma practice, and take any of the perspectives that work for you and leave the rest. And maybe even from the way that I talked about it, there's a different one that's come up for you, which I would actually be happy to hear about. You know, the way that you relate to your practice. So in all of this, you know, this talking, the listening, you know, there's something being conveyed with words, ideas, energetically sometimes too. And really it's all about skillful means in some way. So whatever it is that helps us to move on for a while, then hold that perspective. And then when that becomes no longer useful, put it down and then find another one. So if these 13 help you, if you go through them in sequence, even, you know, once every 6 months or every year, you know, that's good. And you know, there are many lists in the Dharma. I should say this is not some definitive list. This is just my reflection. So in case you were writing them down and you missed one, you think, what was that? Number 11. It's okay. So the Buddha also talked about this, you know, in crossing the flood. He used many metaphors, and one of them was, you know, crossing the flood, that, you know, there's a raft of the practice and the teachings, and then when you get to the other side, like, you put down the raft. So in some ways, in our journey, in our spiritual path, I think it's actually like a journey over many different kinds of terrain. You know, so sometimes we have to use a raft, sometimes we have to swing from vines, sometimes we have to put on the ice boots and stuff. And, you know. So in each phase, just staying actively engaged. Like, what's here in my practice? What's here in my life? And then, what's the helpful perspective that will help me continue to engage, continue to move forward in some way? And you don't need to carry all of them. You don't need to carry the ice axe and the raft and the head and all this stuff. You know, really. When one is done, put it down and then take up what's helpful and move forward. So I sincerely hope that these reflections are helpful to you. Thank you for your attention. So we have a little time if there's questions people have, or if you want to share a different perspective that you've had that's helpful for you. I'm also happy to hear that. Yeah. To read the rest of the poem? You know, I didn't actually bring the entire poem, but you could look it up. I only copied down three of the verses that I liked the best, but I'll read those again if you want. Among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. The river is moving. The blackbird must be flying. So she said the thing about the train made her relate to remember about how she's getting off the train. Yeah. So tell me a little, what happens?
I mean, it's just like I can see myself hook and get on the train and go very far, and that's fine. And then very abruptly, oh my gosh, I don't want to be here. I want to be back on the moment and the truth and the present.
Uh-huh.
Just cut it off.
Mm. Right. Okay, it's good you noticed that, yeah. Because then you've actually changed track onto the abusive train. So she's describing, like, she's on a train and then she suddenly, like, notices that, and then, but then she's kind of, like, flagellating a little bit about that. Right? Yeah, we transfer quite quickly like that, you know, onto this different one. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that's how it happens. So in some ways, like, particularly if it's the same one over and over again, that happens, and you're like, oh, I know that. I don't want to get on the anger train, but I'm on the anger train again. Ah, oh, how does this happen? I mean, one thing is that it's actually just really humbling to notice the power of habits of mind. And it's helpful. It's helpful to see the power of habits of mind like that. So just noticing that, and that that's happened on its own, and then whatever point that you wake up from it, notice that that also has happened on its own. You know, that's interesting to see too, right? Like you can see the selflessness in those moments of awakening too. Because that was not scripted any more than the anger was scripted, right? If so, you would have scripted it much earlier, right? So you can see then, I mean, the selflessness, anatta, is seen in that moment of that. So there's insight possible, you know, even in that whole dynamic of that. And then really to be very compassionate and kind as we can, you know, to recognize that, like, yeah, this is this process, this practice of clear seeing. And I mean, what I think about is, like, yeah, when the wisdom eye is open, when mindfulness is strong, when wisdom is strong, then we can actually see in some train going by that is some train we don't want to be on, we could actually see it clearly and then let it go. Right? But most of the time, if our habit the last 10,000 times has been to get in the train, you know, unless the wisdom eye is like fully opened, then it's gonna blink shut and then we're on the train. Okay. Or interestingly, sometimes you see it clearly, it's like, oh, anger train, don't wanna get on that. And then, yeah, then the eye blinks shut, then we're on the train, then we wake up again like, what, how'd I get here? So then it's like, okay, wow, look at that. Yeah, just, I mean, really, it's very interesting to observe like this. It's very interesting to see that and like, just notice how often that happens. You know, the power of the habits of mind are so strong. So then this also can motivate you more, you know, to try to be present as best we can. You know, plant the seeds of with the intentions of mindfulness and different activities, the intentions of presence. And also actually the more that we see the ickiness of these, where those trains go, the more motivation we have not to get on them too. You know? Because in some ways, why do we always go to this place? It's because there's some way in which the unawakened mind thinks it's a good idea. You know, like the unawakened mind thinks that hatred is a good strategy for safety. Like, I will hate you and that will be my shield. Now when you examine that more closely, you can see like, oh, that's actually like burning. You know, it's not actually a protection. It's actually a harm that's happening. But because we're not looking at it closely enough, we're not paying attention, we're not feeling that burn, then, you know, the wisdom hasn't developed yet. So then we get to feel that burn over and over again. Yeah.
And that felt like so relaxing, such a refuge, even though so often in our lives we're being asked to know and to perform and figure out and strategize and multitask. So to really be in a place of not knowing and not having to know is a lovely piece that I will definitely adore. So
yeah, you're welcome. So appreciating the resting in the not knowing piece. Yeah, there's some sort of a beautiful like openness and wonder that we can cultivate in that way too. That, you know, many times children have that like a little bit more, and then we, as we grow up, as you're saying, like there's more an idea that like I need to know everything. If I know, I need to pretend that I know, and you know, stuff like that. So it's like, oh, just allowing yourself to relax and see. Yeah. It's more fun, you know, too. Right?
Okay. I'd like to second that appreciation and the not knowingness, because I think the contradictory nature of some of the things you presented helps us to sort of, it helps me to not corral the things that I find that resonate with me immediately into this little stable, sometimes waiting to see if something really contradicts. Takes a little time, and just being able to sit. These things are contradictory, but they sort of both point toward waking up.
Yeah.
And so it's not a matter of collecting the things that you cherry pick out of the Dharma that just reinforce your own view.
Right.
It's about, well, this thing is totally different. What's it gonna do?
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, and in that also, that sort of a moving towards or opening to that which is a little scary to us too, which can include even just this whole perspective that there's this different way of knowing that we're cultivating in Dharma practice. And the thinking mind may not like that, you know, may be like kind of threatened by that, and is constantly kind of reasserting, or there's a way in which the fictitious ego is constantly like reclaiming everything, including Dharma practice itself and knowing. And well, now I know about not knowing. Yes, I know that. It's like, you know, observe how quickly that comes in. It's like, now I'm going to talk to everyone about not knowing because I know about it. And it's very deep, and I heard it in a talk. And now, you know, it's just funny how the mind does that, you know. So, yeah. Yeah.
So I'll third that. So I must be practicing a lot more than I thought I was.
Yeah, I think there's definitely aspects of going to sleep at night that can inform our practice for sure. So among them, I'll say, one is the deep relaxation that it takes to go to sleep. You know, and you could even say that there's a real, you can try to attend to this, be interested in this, but you know, the moment of full relaxation that it could happen right before you fall asleep, is kind of the level of relaxation of letting go of what we're I won't say aiming for, but already, because already that's a striving. You know, the words are difficult with this, but that is conducive, that is conducive to the practice. So that level of relaxation. Also as instructive is like when we're asleep, our relationship to dreams when we wake up. So oftentimes if we've had dreams while we're asleep, when we wake up, we kind of ponder them a little, but in some kind of way that's not fully identified in the same way that we are with waking thoughts. You know, so we'll consider like, oh yeah, like this, it's kind of like, oh, this dream visited me, kind of, right? And maybe there's something to be learned from it. It may be kind of impressionistic or some emotional thing or something. But we kind of take the kernels that seem useful and then kind of let it go. So usually people don't take their dreams absolutely, completely, literally. Like, now I need to become a unicorn and chase this, you know, it's like, you know, but it, then, you know, we might be like, oh, in this dream I was a unicorn, and then, oh, okay, you know, you get some sense of, like, some thing that's been revealed from it, and then you can take that and then let go of the rest. So you could notice, like, what would it be like if we actually related to our waking thoughts in the same way? You know, like, they were actually kind of visitations from who knows what conglomerations, that sometimes have useful information for us, that sometimes are just gobbledygooks, you know, and just not be as tight around like I, me, my thought, you know, all this stuff. So yeah, it's interesting to observe that, and even observing, you know, the sense of self. So there's a way in which, from waking from sleep, there's some interesting transition that happens. Between when we're sleeping and when which we emerge and arise with some sense of me again. So get interested if you can, you know, in like what happens in that transition, you know, what happens in that waking up, you know, the connection to the body, for example, like a reconnection to the experience of the physical body in a different way, or, yeah. It's just interesting, and this is where, you know, when we cultivate this awareness, we can actually apply it in all these different ways that reveal a lot about life and even these very simple transitions of that happen every day, you know, our moments for learning, for awakening, for understanding. Thank you. Yeah.
I realized that letting go into not knowing me also could mean actually acting on something.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily just being, but letting go into not knowing, not having to know everything about a situation before I act, and trusting, the part of trusting that deeper inside me, if I let go,
yeah,
that part, deeper part, will guide me in the right direction. And so, but I had an experience of it today of just having to let go into not knowing what I should do in the situation. And when I did that, then I felt I knew what I should do.
Mm-hmm.
How I should act. So it's sort of this mindful, being mindful of my body and my sensations, but not necessarily having to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And make a decision from my head and the thinking part.
Right.
Just experiencing what was going on in my body and then letting go, and it came to me what I should
right.
do.
Yeah, she's describing an experience of this dropping into letting go of not, and resting in not knowing, and that informing a decision that she made today. And yeah, it's good as we practice this, then that can become more of the way that we live, you know, in combination with the information that we get through the rational thinking mind, you know, which is good for, certainly for some things, very helpful and good, but oftentimes in combination, most of the time in combination, right? Occasionally things like, you know, selecting a cell phone plan or something, it can pretty much make a rational thinking mind can have that one, right? But then most actual important decisions in our life It's helpful to have this different way of knowing, this intuitive connection, and we can cultivate that, including by coming to the retreat this weekend.